You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot. Welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, April 3rd, 2025. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
And I'm your host, Amy Owen. In tonight's news, Madison Metro's general manager is stepping down after 5 transformative years in public transit.
A newcomer is joining the Madison School Board.
An incumbent alder who ran unopposed on Tuesday outlines his vision for the city of Madison.
And in the second half, Out of the Box shares a redemptive story. The House Always Wins talks countertops. And Radio Chipstone remembers the long, hot summer of 1967.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
World Service.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. Donald Trump has defended the tariffs he's imposed on U.S. imports from around the world, despite a global stock market sell-off. Wall Street has suffered its worst day since the early months of the COVID pandemic. The Dow Jones fell by nearly 4%. Michelle Fleury has more from New York.
U.S. stocks suffered their biggest one-day loss since 2020, and the dollar tumbled. The combination of a blanket 10% tariff on all imports to the States and higher levies for many countries has sparked fears that an escalating trade war could trigger a recession. Among the biggest losers are the companies investors think are most exposed to this new world order of trade. The sportswear giant Nike has seen its business model shattered at a stroke of the president's pen. Trainers that are made in Vietnam will now be subject to a 46% tariff.
The World Trade Organization has revised its forecast for global economic growth sharply downwards in the light of the new U.S. tariffs. In contrast to its previous forecast of 3% growth for the world economy this year, the agency now expects a contraction of 1%. Lesotho says it'll send a government delegation to the United States to plead its case after Washington imposed 50% tariffs on its imports. Thousands of people in Lesotho are employed making clothes for the U.S. market under a tax-free initiative set up to help countries come out of poverty. Tebo Kobeli is a textile company owner there.
This has been a devastating day for us. We have been going up and down meeting different stakeholders. We met up with government officials, government ministers to discuss a way forward. And the government confirmed a great support in textile. Also, they are looking into meeting up with the American government. They are with us. We must continue production.
Gaza's Hamas-run civil defense agency says an Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced people east of Gaza City has killed at least 31 people. Israel says it had targeted a Hamas command center. Gaza's health ministry says around 100 people have been killed in Israeli strikes over the last day. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, told the Security Council the Israeli actions had violated international law.
The Israeli military continues to strike camps for people who have been displaced numerous times, who have nowhere safe to go. The Israeli military also continues to force civilians to move. Half of Gaza is now under mandatory evacuation orders or has been declared a no-go zone. These orders fail to comply with the requirements of international humanitarian law.
BBC News. The Pentagon says it'll investigate the U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over his use of a messaging app to discuss airstrikes on Yemen. Last week, it emerged a journalist was accidentally invited to the group on Signal. Senior officials, including the Vice President J.D. Vance, mentioned the timing of attacks against the Houthis as well as the missiles involved. Donald Trump's senior advisor on Africa says the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo has agreed on what he called a path forward to mining mineral reserves. Massad Boula spoke after talks with President Felix Tshisekedi in Kinshasa. Mr. Tshisekedi believes U.S. involvement in extracting minerals could help quell the violence that's plagued the country for nearly 30 years. Iranian media say a former senior judge who had been involved in the execution of thousands of political prisoners has died after a long illness. Hossein Ali Nayeri was head of the so-called Death Committee that oversaw the mass executions in 1988. An indigenous rights group has warned that social media influencers pose a new threat to uncontacted tribes. It follows the arrest of an American tourist who had traveled to a prohibited Indian Ocean island in an apparent attempt to contact the Sentinelese people. Jessica McCallin has this story.
Survival International described Mykhailo Viktorovich's behavior as reckless and idiotic. Not only did he endanger his own life, the charity said, but also the lives of the Sentinelese. Like many uncontacted tribes, they have no immunity to common diseases like flu or measles and could be completely wiped out by them. The 24-year-old reportedly filmed his visit and left a can of Coca-Cola on the shore as an offering to the tribe, but doesn't seem to have made any contact with them.
BBC World News.
This is Christina Leffring and Amy Owen with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. Reeling from last November's oversight in Madison that allowed 193 absentee ballots to go uncounted, city and county election officials took action Tuesday to make sure that slip-up wouldn't be repeated. According to the Capital Times, additional checklists and a new election supervisor were added to ensure that no vote goes uncounted. City Clerk Maribeth Witzel-Bell was placed on administrative leave because of the uncounted ballots, and City Attorney Mike Haas took over her job temporarily. Meanwhile, an anonymous social media post claimed falsely that 7 Wisconsin counties ran out of ballots Tuesday. The Poynter Institute's PolitiFact investigative service found that the only polling places that ran out of ballots were in the city of Milwaukee, where turnout was higher than expected. The polling places were eventually supplied with more ballots, and everyone got an opportunity to vote.
State Supreme Court candidate Brad Schimmel's allies and his opponent praised Schimmel's high road concession speech Tuesday night, in which he declared he had lost to liberal Susan Crawford fair and square. The admission broke with the recent pattern of behavior from defeated conservatives, including failed gubernatorial candidate Eric Hovde and unsuccessful Supreme Court hopeful Daniel Kelly. Addressing angry shouts from the crowd, Schimmel refused to sow doubt, telling supporters to, quote, accept the results, the Associated Press reported. Crawford said Wednesday that the call she got from Schimmel conceding the race was, quote, the way elections should conclude.
A 2018 law that stripped the state's executive branch of the power to allocate revenue from court settlements has come before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The Republican-dominated state legislature passed the law in a lame duck session after Democrat Tony Evers defeated Republican incumbent Scott Walker for governor. Attorney General Josh Call, also a Democrat, sued the legislature over the law, claiming it violates the constitutional separation of powers. The court began hearing arguments in the case Wednesday.
While several school districts in Dane County got voter approval Tuesday to raise their levies beyond limits set by the state, the percentage of districts statewide that succeeded in getting similar referendums passed continues to slip. School districts in Belleville, Deerfield, and Marshall got the okay from voters to raise taxes for operations or capital expenditures, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Across Wisconsin, though, school referendum approvals were not guaranteed. Of 89 school referendums proposed statewide this spring, 51 were approved for a success rate of 57%. Wisconsin voters approved 70% of school referendums during 2024.
A practice where Wisconsin counties charge absent fathers the cost of their children's birth if the mothers are on Medicaid is something Governor Tony Evers would like to end. Evers proposes an offer in his 2025-27 budget where the state would provide almost $4 million more to county child support agencies if they agree to end the policy known as birth cost recovery. Under the current practice, the counties get to keep 15% of the money they obtain from fathers to be used for child support, with the rest refunded to Medicaid. In only two states, Wisconsin and Kansas, is birth cost recovery permitted, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. Critics of the practice say the fathers who face birth cost recovery charges often have low income themselves, and repaying the charges could hinder their ability to pay child support.
Spending $292 million to replace the unloved Humanities Building on the University of Wisconsin campus would eliminate the need for $70 million in deferred maintenance work, a top UW official tells the Capital Times. The 1960s-era concrete structure, known officially as Mossy Humanities Building, suffers from water leaks and other major structural problems, Vice Chancellor Cindy Tortzweit says. The UW is seeking $262 million to advance the project, the Capital Times says, with the remainder coming from grants and private donations. Governor Tony Evers supports the project. He said he took a class in the building as a college student decades ago and found the experience, quote, cold and wet.
With a scant amount of snow in Madison this winter, the city is reporting that snow removal complaints are down from previous years. From the beginning of October to the end of March, the city received 553 snow removal complaints from residents, down from 866 in the previous winter. Madison for 22.1 inches of snow this past winter, 15 inches less than in the same period the previous winter.
The Madison School District Board of Education has a newly elected member, Martha Saravo, who beat competitor Brett Wagner on Tuesday. Saravo received about 55% of the vote, to Wagner's 45%. In the number of votes cast, the difference was around 11,000 votes. WORT reporter David Aaron spoke with Saravo earlier this afternoon about her priorities.
Martha Saravo is a disability rights advocate and founder of Madtown Mamas and Disability Advocates. She's a single mother whose daughter is in the sixth grade. Saravo told me her first priority is to implement an educational process called Universal Design for Learning, or UDL. Here's her description of the method.
Universal Design for Learning, I think, would be very complementary to continue to raise outcomes for students, as Universal Design focuses on finding out where students' strengths lie and honing in on them from as early on as possible. That kind of caters a little bit more to students' learning styles and understanding that everyone's neurodiverse and we all learn in different ways. It pulls out those learning strategies for students earlier, and then it also helps the teachers, gives them more tools in their tool belt to have more adaptable programming and to kind of pull students together that learn in a very similar fashion.
Her other priorities are twofold. First, to have better staffing of special education assistants.
As a parent and by someone who's been watching what our district has been doing and responses to requests for additional staff over the years, I know we have a teacher shortage, and I know we have a budget problem. With those two things in mind, addressing our ability to say, yes, here's another staff member, I would love that to be the norm, instead of us having to say, oh, no, it looks like you're fully staffed, even though you're requesting extra people. I don't think that should stay the norm, because that's kind of where it is right now.
Another priority, continuing advocacy at the legislative level.
Because of the Madtown Mamas group that I've been part of, we've always been advocating in a multiple level fashion, which means not only have we been doing stuff locally and within the Madison School District, we also do things legislatively. And so expectations upon myself for being part of the Madison School Board is to continue that work and expand upon it.
I asked Saravo her views on two issues that have been topics of concern in Madison and much of the country. First, the problem of cell phone use in schools.
My answer on cell phones is I don't think they should be completely eliminated, but there is appropriate use. And I do not know how we get more down a path that leads us usability that would be typical in a work setting. The reason that they should have some use within schools goes into sometimes students, I use them for medical needs. I know that some students are using them to translate. Some students are using them because that's what they can afford and use and replace more easily than they can, let's say, a laptop. So I think it's complicated.
Second is the use of police stationed in schools, or what is known as school resource officers.
I support maintaining what we currently have. Well, if you take them out, what do you replace them with? And then how do you do things in a more productive and more proactive manner while also maintaining security standards? We have a lot of really good safety and security staff within the schools that I highly support. We also have what we call community leaders in our schools. And those are from different organizations in the Madison community simply to support students and to be there kind of within the classrooms and in the hallways for students to go to if they need an adult, and promoting positive interactions in schools.
Saravo takes office later this month. She'll replace outgoing member Laura Simkin, who did not run for re-election. Two other current members of the MMSD school board, Allie Muldrow and Nichelle Nichols, were re-elected on Tuesday. They had no competitor. For WORT News, I'm David Ahrens.
The City of Madison announced yesterday that Metro Transit's general manager is stepping down later this spring after overseeing a transformative 5 years for public transportation in our city. WORT News producer Faye Parks has more.
Planning ahead for an ambitious overhaul of Madison's bus system, the city hired Justin Steuenberg as Metro Transit's general manager in spring of 2020. He's leaving this spring for a job in the private sector, according to an announcement yesterday from the city. Steuenberg oversaw a redesign of Madison's transit network in 2023, which reconfigured bus routes and schedules and changed more than 2,000 stops throughout the city. That redesign was done in preparation for Bus Rapid Transit, Mayor Saati Rhodes Conway's signature project to modernize the city's infrastructure and accommodate Madison's growing population. The first rapid route launched this fall, running every 15 minutes on weekdays and Saturdays from Madison's far west side, across the isthmus, and to the east side. Both the network redesign and the BRT launch had its critics, and the rollout has had hiccups. Some hopeful BRT riders were left waiting this fall when the doors on the new articulated buses wouldn't open on demand. But Steuenberg says that a general unfamiliarity with a new BRT system was the biggest challenge.
You know, our drivers were driving it for the first time outside of, you know, a training class, so the first time in kind of real-world situations. Our passengers were using it for the first time in most cases, and so there was just a learning curve across the board. And, of course, we would, you know, always love to have more time to train, but, you know, it's not always in the cards. And so a lot of our early challenges besides the doors were just related to just unfamiliarity by both our staff as well as the general public, and that has largely worked itself out.
Steuenberg adds that he and his staff were prepared for the growing pains. Before he came to Madison, he oversaw the implementation of a bus rapid transit program in Indianapolis.
So I kind of knew the severity of those challenges and worked to educate, I think, a lot of other folks on how difficult these things would be. Those challenges were not unexpected to me, but they were very big challenges nonetheless.
Steuenberg characterizes Madison's transit overhaul as successful. He says bus riders are quote-unquote voting with their feet, citing a more than 20% increase in BRT ridership and a 15% increase system-wide in January and February.
We've delivered on nearly all of the major projects that we had planned to do. So our system is fundamentally different than it was 5 years ago. That was all very necessary. But there is a lot of change fatigue here at Metro. Just the volume and speed of change has been significant. And with any change, when you make the change, it's not going to be perfect right away, right? It takes some time to kind of iterate and improve our processes, our training, you know, all of that to make sure that the final product is as good as it can be. And so that's what I really hope for my successor to come in with that real focus on just continuous improvement and identifying, you know, little tweaks here and there that continue to make the system and the service just a little bit better every single day so that we, you know, continue to refine and improve that those outcomes and the service on the street.
News of Steuenberg's departure comes as the city and the union representing transit workers are negotiating a contract. A top concern for the Teamster local, on-the-job safety. 5 assaults have taken place on city buses this year, including a high-profile attack on a driver that caused a bus to smash into the side of a business. The union is hosting a press conference tomorrow on the rash of attacks and other pertinent safety issues. Both Stuenberg and a union spokesperson declined to share any updates today on their negotiations. Stuenberg's last day on the job is May 30th. Park Superintendent Eric Knepp will fill in as acting manager of Metro Transit while a national search is underway for Stuenberg's successor. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
A documentary film featuring one of America's innovative illustrators hits the Wisconsin Film Festival this weekend. Art Spiegelman, Disaster is My Muse, explores the life and career of cartoonist, the story of his parents' survival of the Holocaust, and his own struggle to come to terms with this legacy. Reporter Maria Segura has more.
Everything I know, I learned from comic books. I learned how to read from looking at Batman and trying to figure out whether he was a good guy or a bad guy. And ethics, aesthetics, and everything else from Mad Magazine.
That's cartoonist Art Spiegelman, who is best known for the serialized graphic novel Mouse. Unlike most cartoons, the subject of Mouse, full name, A Survivor's Tale, is Spiegelman's father, and specifically his experiences as a survivor of the Holocaust. Mouse won a Pulitzer Prize, and it's regularly listed on lists of the most influential books. But Spiegelman's career spans further than that. Spiegelman, now 77, worked as an artist and writer for the New Yorker magazine from 1993 to 2003, where he was best known for his many provocative covers. His other works include The Shadow of No Towers, The Wild Party, and Breakdowns. The film screening at this year's Wisconsin Film Festival tracks Spiegelman's storied career starting in the 1960s. It's called Art Spiegelman, Disaster is My Muse. Alicia Sams is a documentary producer. She tells WORT Today that Spiegelman's creative motivation stems from his childhood, his life, and growing up in Queens with parents who survived the Holocaust.
I think his passion comes from being engaged in his world and in his own life. Mouse came out of an attempt to try and understand what he was doing here, how he had come into existence when all the forces in Europe at the time were sort of basically trying to wipe out his parents and his family.
Sam says Spiegelman's drive is also infused with his experiences in politics and culture.
You know, that's what makes an artist, is when it hits the universal and it hits all of us. So his New Yorker one-shots about things that happened in New York in the 90s, you know, police violence with Amadou Diallo and the Crown Heights, New York, when there were riots between the Jewish residents and black residents. And he did a Valentine's cover, which is in the film, of a Orthodox Jew kissing a West Indian African-American woman. I mean, those kinds of things. Like, he is reacting to events of his time and making sense of them for himself and for all of us. You know, it's commentary.
Sam says Spiegelman has a good relationship with his wife, who has supported his endeavors and his passion as a cartoonist, and that he continues to receive support from his fellow friends, coworkers, and people today.
There's the art of comics. There's Art himself, who's just a fascinating raconteur. His relationship with Françoise Mouly is incredible, his wife and partner, and also the art editor of The New Yorker, who's responsible for all the amazing New Yorker covers we see every week. And then there is the witness to history and the witness to what's happening today.
The documentary film Art Spiegelman, Disaster's My Muse, is a portrait of an artist fully engaged with the past and the present. Spiegelman chose comics as a medium to tell a story and to help make sense of the world through collective histories and make sense of the world today. The film screens this Saturday, April 5th at 5:15 p.m. at the Marquee at Union South. It's one of a dizzying number of films screening this year at the Wisconsin Film Festival, which kicks off tonight and runs through next Thursday. For WORT News, I'm Maria Segura.
Alder Bill Tischler was appointed to the City Council in 2022 to fill a resigned seat and later elected for another term in 2023. He's one of a handful of incumbent alders who ran unopposed this spring. His name was the only one that appeared on Tuesday's ballot for voters in Westside District 11. Sitting down with WORT reporter Sutton Johnson, Alder Tischler described his vision for a more sustainable, affordable Madison.
I'm Bill Tischler. I'm the alder for District 11. I've been in Madison my entire life. This is about the right point in my life where I can really give back to a city and to a community that's really shaped who I am. day job is I work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I also have an appointment with the Department of Corrections where I work on adult education for those who are incarcerated.
What did you spend the most time on in your latest term on the council?
The environment and also traffic safety. I have several greenways in my district that have been neglected for many years. And so I worked with area residents and managed to find support, and we restored one of the greenways. The other greenway, it was just kind of seen as a drainage ditch. When there was a lot of flooding in the area, there was discussions about turning this greenway into a retention pond. So I worked with the city, I worked with local residents, and we were able to come up with solutions, and it's been very successful. For traffic safety, been working also with city staff to really address the speeding that goes on in District 11. So I've worked to put in a lot of traffic calming features and also to put in flashing lights, visible crosswalks for residents.
A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job paying about $28 per hour, or about $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
District 11 was really designed back when we had another housing crisis back in the 50s. As a result, a lot of the neighborhood is centered around the automobile. Of the four major shopping malls that were designed back in the late 50s, early 60s, outside of downtown, three of them were in District 11. What we have, or we had in our district, was a lot of big open spaces for parking for cars. We're now seeing these spaces being turned into more shops, but also for apartments and condominiums with parking then underground. We've been successful getting some affordable housing put into these spaces, and I'd like to see more of that because you're having affordable housing right where the shops are, the stores, the schools, and also right on the major bus lines.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. The property tax raise gives us more time to address other issues. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes?
The referendum that was passed does give the city a lot more opportunities to work closer with the state to address funding that we don't always receive. Extending our services to the surrounding community would also be a way to allow them to continue to grow, can become a potential source of revenue. We also have a lot of state office buildings, and we have the university. Another area where we need to work closer with these public state entities and get the city's fair share they owe us for the services that we do provide. I think what would benefit the whole community is to establish a regional transit authority, and that would allow the city to grow our services, but also to expand our bus services.
What issue are you excited to work on?
The way I kind of address topics that I want to be more engaged with is I run a book club. One of the books that we're kind of examining right now is the book Killed by a Traffic Engineer. And that's giving the opportunity to examine what we've been doing over the years in engineering our streets, mainly centered around the automobile, and how we can make adjustments to make our streets more accessible and safer for pedestrians and bikers. The other one that I also want to focus on is we talk a lot about traffic safety, but we don't talk a lot about parking. Sometimes we spend more money parking cars than we do spend on housing for people. The last thing I want to also address is the environment. And as we continue to grow and create higher density, we also have to have green spaces. So those are kind of the main areas, traffic, parking, and then having more green spaces.
Your district is one that last year had significant pushback to the West Area Plan under a new framework for urban planning. Residents in your district had a lot of concerns, from things like the Sauk Creek Greenway to fears over how their neighborhoods might change. Can you talk about how you see the West Side changing, if at all? And can you talk about balancing those concerns with the need for more housing across the city?
At one point in time, actually in my own time, District 11 was the edge of the city. It was the West Side. We have a lot of people who are wrestling with this shift in identity, shift in thinking. And so we are applying a lot of the needs and wants that we see in the areas that are closer to downtown. And we're applying that same kind of views to now the near West Side. At the same time, we're still making the same mistakes or enabling the same kind of behavior as we expand further out into the city. So we're putting a lot of pressure on areas that were once designed as complete neighborhoods, a lot of, you know, low residential, to rapidly change and to have more housing, just going a few miles beyond these kind of near West Side, a lot of the same kind of housing that we were building back in the 50s. I think it's possible to have a balance in the neighborhoods. And what we're seeing right now is a lot of growth and development in areas that were set aside back in the 50s, early 60s for high density. We're seeing, you know, in some cases, 16, 17 stories buildings going up. I think that's kind of where the, you know, some of the concerns that residents have is that there's a lot of pressure put on areas that are near downtown, where the same pressure is not put as we get further outside of the downtown area. We can then kind of work our way inwards. We still have the same idea of everything radiates out from the downtown. Not everybody works downtown. Not everybody shops downtown. Not everybody goes downtown.
The council has also grappled with the question of whether to censor a fellow alder and is having ongoing discussions about what to do when a colleague faces severe allegations. It is a bit of a different situation when someone's elected rather than hired by the city. How has your thinking evolved about the personnel of who is on the council and what checks and balances should be in place?
Well, I worked on the code of conduct. I see it as kind of a working document. You know, we were never really thinking that it would be implemented at this scale. And so now we're going back and relooking at this. Each alder, you know, has to walk into the job and be accountable for their actions. That said, when somebody, you know, has done things in the past that are not correct, that has to be, you know, taken into consideration. And I think the more transparency and the more accountability, the more questioning that we have, the better choices the public will make. Once the public makes their decision, I think it largely falls under the public to decide when it's time for those individuals to no longer represent them.
Alder Bill Tischler ran unopposed this spring and is entering his second full-length term on the City Council. You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories coming up in the second half of the show. Out of the Box shares a redemption story, The House Always Wins talks countertops, and Radio Chipstone remembers the long hot summer of 1967.
But now we'll take a quick break. Back in a flash.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
The time is now 6:34, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring, here with my co-host, Amy Owen. Thank you for joining us.
Justin Yap is the founder of Yapography, a video production and digital media consulting firm based here in Madison. Growing up in a small town, the allure of a rebellious lifestyle led him down a path of addiction and crime, ending in a lengthy stay in the Columbia County Jail. Yap and host D Star discuss the challenges of finding work with a criminal record in this edition of Out of D Box.
Being a convicted felon, people just look at you like, why would I want to give you a what? No, I don't want you to be a part of my team.
Right.
So I don't know how our society expects people to better themselves when you're not given the opportunity to do so. And so I had to struggle and work 10 times harder than the average person to get the same level of respect and care and jobs, right? I had to beg for like really bad jobs, jobs that most people don't want. I had to beg for that stuff. There's a problem that needs to be addressed someday.
Yeah. I mean, now it's like, really, dude,
right.
You know, I can't get on a roof and, you know,
right.
Lay some shingles because I got a felony 10 years ago. Come on.
There were some employers that gave me the chances, though, and I respect them. You know, Mankey Enterprises out of Lodi was my first job out of the can that said, you know what, we're going to take a chance on you, and gave me a job. It paid like crap at first, but after putting in the time, they quickly realized that was a good investment, and they upped my pay. And I was, by the time I left, I was making 18, 20 bucks an hour, and this is back in early 2000s. So that was some pretty good change. You know, I made some good money to save up, buy my first camera, enroll into college where I went to Madison Media Institute. I went there, graduated, got my degree in video and motion graphics. So I got out of college, and entrepreneurialism was kind of a part of me, but I never like, I inspired to be an entrepreneur.
Well, your mom laid the foundation, though.
She
right?
did, for sure, yeah. But it was never like something I'm like, that was not my target, right? I wanted to make movies. I wanted to be like a producer or whatever, like, you know, be in Hollywood, whatever. That was more of my ambitions starting out. But the being the convicted felon thing, I was being passed up repeatedly on opportunities, strictly from that. There was times I would have job interviews, two of them, the three coming in, showing me around the office, blah, 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 introducing me to people, giving names like, oh, this is Justin, you're going to be working with him.
Right. Getting your hopes up.
Getting my hopes up. And then they're like, you know, this is so great. We're so lucky to have you. The final thing is we've got to do a drug test and a background check, and we'll get you onboarded. I'm like, all right, sweet. 3 weeks go by, nothing. I passed the drug test for sure because I wasn't doing anything at the time. And that was it. I would follow up by, oh, hey, oh, yeah, well, we just, the person, you know, once you got him on the phone, you got him in a corner, you're forcing something out of him, right? Oh, well, we found somebody a little bit more qualified than you, and so we decided to go that route. At that point, I was at my breaking point. I'm like, you showed me around three times now. The third time, you actually introduced me to people and showed me the office, quote unquote, where I'd be working at. Like, you looked at my background and you don't want to give me a job because I'm a convicted felon. Oh, no, that's not true. I'm like, you were not going to say that because that's illegal for you to not hire me, but that's why.
So it seems like things are going really well for you, and you've overcome some obstacles and you've made amends for those. And people are starting to see that. One of the ways that people are starting to see that is you were granted a pardon.
Yeah, I was. Thankfully, I mean, it was a long process. I had started the application process in 2019, and then the pandemic hit, right? And then everything was shut down for a while. Stuff got lost in the mix. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, like I hadn't heard nothing. And then in 2022 or 21, they started reviewing stuff again, but there was a backlog of stuff. I was like, oh, so I got a notification that the application and all that stuff was going to be reviewed. So, all right. In 2023, I got another letter stating that I had been accepted to be considered for a pardon. Like they reviewed it. They thought I'd be a good candidate. So the next stage is that you got to present yourself to a board. They used to do this in person, but since COVID, they now do it through Zoom. And it's in front of like five or six peers of the, it's not just like government people. It's other, like there was a pastor on there. There was
community leaders.
Yeah. Community leaders, exactly. Yep. There was five or six of them. And so I had to present my case to them as well. After they had read my application and all that stuff, I had 10 letters of recommendations, laid out, you know, the facts about why I felt like I was ready to, I accepted responsibility for my actions as a kid. I have moved on. I paid my debt. And I felt like I should no longer be held back by that. Not that I necessarily want a corporate job, but I'm just like, I just don't want that anymore, right? I want to be able to say I'm a full-fledged citizen again. And politics is something I've been considering running for anyways, and people have told me I would be good at it. But up until recently, most positions in politics you can't hold if you're a convicted felon, I guess, right, other than presidency. But we're not going to go there. So that was my biggest rebuttal for why I wanted one. It wasn't to own a gun or nothing like that. I just focused on my professionalism, where I wanted to go with it, and politics being something that I was going to be considering if I was granted this opportunity to do. One of my best achievements to this day now, right? Like doing a 180 in my life, flipping it around and being recognized for that. So it was heartfelt, meaningful, and hopefully I can pay it back forward someday in politics and help other people like myself that weren't given opportunities to get opportunities like that. You know, criminal reform is something I want to focus on in the future. So that's something I will have on my back burners as we move forward in life.
So tell us about your business. Like, sure, what kind of products and services do you offer, and what are some of the notable projects that you've worked on, and what are some of the things that you are most proud of?
I wish I could say, you know, I'm working on feature films and stuff like that. Not the case. It's corporate stuff. But it's important stuff, right? People all have stories to tell. And so being a storyteller, I'm like, this is an area I can focus on. It's not advertising per se, right? I'm not just making a bunch of in your face advertisements to buy, buy, buy. It's who is the business, right? Who are you? Why does your audience and clientele care to work with you? And so I try to find the cores on that and help bring that all into a cohesive visual storytelling video that encapsulates what problems are you solving for your clientele's. Videos that people actually want to watch versus something that's in your face that you can't skip for 10 seconds. Typically, those are the kind of areas I look for, organic type of storytelling versus a typical ad. You know, I try to stay away from those. I do the ads sometimes, but more storytelling. Like, what, everyone's got the story. What is it? What's your why? I like to focus on those. And it can be from any size corporation to small business, as long as the budget's there nowadays, right? Like, I'm 12 years in now, so I'm pretty seasoned. I'm happy to say I can help anyone solve their media needs. I might not be the one producing it for them, but I got people that do, are just getting into the game. They're just starting off. And a lot of times, you know, if it's a smaller budget project, I'm happy to like hand them off to people that I know will still do them right, that need the attention, that need the work, that need to build their portfolio up and then still help this small business out that couldn't quite afford me, but was able to afford something. That to me is still a win, right? Like, I still helped achieve that small business's needs, even though I'm not the ones telling the story this time around, but consulting, I also do consulting, I guess would be what I'm trying to get at.
That was Justin Yap sitting down with host D Star. You can listen to the rest of their conversation on the Out of D Box podcast.
Got countertops? Allie and John sure have opinions about those. They'll share the pros and cons of various types of countertops in this archival edition of The House Always Wins. I call it housework, cause it's light work. What you gonna do? I'ma throw
shapes, filling the base till my feet hurt. Hey! I call it housework. Hello, everybody. I'm John.
And I'm Allie. And welcome to The House Always Wins, where you can learn cool stuff about your house.
There's a lot of choices out there for countertop. Laminate countertops, which a lot of people have. There's solid surface. There's various stones, wood countertops. There's concrete. But let's start at the beginning, right? You just did kitchen.
Mm-hmm, I did.
So what did you install for the countertops there?
So I did a kitchen for an apartment that I own, and I chose laminate countertops.
Sure.
They're the least expensive option. I made the countertops myself, but I think most people will not have the capacity to do that. Relatively easy to install, relatively lightweight, and it was fairly inexpensive. You know, laminate is like, it's what most countertops are made of for a long time. You can't put hot things on them. That'll
right.
ruin it.
It's so it's plastic.
It's made of plastic, but it does kind of clean up decently well. And yeah. over time, I mean, the laminate countertops I took out of that apartment were 70 years old. So
wow.
they were not pretty, but they were still functional.
Another aspect of them being plastic, too, is like knives, right? So you have to use cutting boards when you add those, right?
For sure.
Yeah, so they don't hold up well. And it's plastic. I think you struck on it as their cost effectiveness is their number one selling feature, right?
Yeah.
They are pretty inexpensive.
I don't like the ones that are supposed to look like marble or supposed to look like
right.
wood. I hate all
yeah.
that. But there are some really fun, funky ones. And that's what I'm all about. Like,
oh,
if
yeah.
you're buying something plastic, lean into the thing that is plastic.
Absolutely. Let's roll with those 50s
exactly.
and 60s looks.
Exactly. So I have this like great pattern called Boomerang. You know.
Shut up. Oh, wait. Is the one with the boomerang pattern?
Yeah. It looks groovy.
Straight out of Atomic 1950s.
Exactly right.
That is the best stuff. And that's the only way you're going to get that awesome look
mm-hmm.
is going in. laminates there. That's so awesome. I love that.
Yeah,
love that.
But then probably a good 20 years ago, solid surface countertops really became popular. And those are, they're like a recycled plastic. They come in a bunch of different colors, but generally you don't have quite the different patterns that you have in, in laminate.
It's usually a more uniform color.
Mm-hmm. So they're a bit more expensive. Than, they're certainly more expensive than laminate, but I don't know. How do you like those?
Well, the pros are, you know, super uniform and it's solid. So it's not a thin layer of plastic on top of a substrate. It's a solid surface. You can get integral sinks built into them, which is nice.
Which is nice.
You can't put hot things down on it. But at the end of the day, it's like laminates, except it's full thickness and it, I don't know, it tends to look nice. You know, it's a real easy surface to work on. You can chop and cut on it. And you, as I recall, you can sand it if you make some marks.
I think you can buff out.
Yeah, you can buff out things.
Flaws and things like that.
Which you can't with laminate for sure. So you can buff out flaws.
Absolutely not. I mean, I do think it, I mean, it looks plasticky to me.
It does.
And I certainly, I've been in the room when it's being worked on. I've actually used it. And boy, howdy, that is like a world of microplastics.
Oh, microplastics and then the glues and epoxies and you kind of you kind of float out. So not maybe the most sustainable product.
Probably not so much, no.
Yeah. Which leads to like another common one, which is the various stones. I mean, everybody.
Those are really popular.
They are. Everybody thinks of the kitchen, they think of their granite countertop, right?
Yeah. And that used to be like such a mark of a very expensive.
Right.
House. And I think actually some of the prices of those things have come down enough that it doesn't set you that far apart.
So sustainability wise, it's actually not nearly as bad, you know, because it's just stone.
Well, that's true, but it's...
So it's not plastics.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I'll push back on it. It's an extremely heavy thing that has to be mined.
Yes.
That has to be transported.
Right.
And none of that is particularly sustainable.
That said, you know, it's tough, right? You can put a hot pan down on it, no problem. Pretty tough stuff. You don't want to be cutting on it. You're not going to hurt the countertop. You're going to make your knives dull.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are some things you don't want to put on it, right? I mean...
It's not very tolerant of like acid, so, you know, your lemons and such like that. So if you're one of those people who just absolutely must put lemons on their countertop, which strangely, I think is actually my household. soapstone.
You know, lemons everywhere. Look at there, there's lemons.
We do make our cocktails.
The truth.
But soapstone is a nice stone because it's a stone that you see in chemistry labs because it's very tolerant of a bunch of crazy chemicals. It's so cool because you can just cut it with like woodworking tools.
Yeah, it's mind blowing.
It blows the mind.
It does. This is a stone that I am cutting with my saw.
Exactly. I mean, you've done it. I've done it. It's crazy that it works as well as it does. But and it's beautiful. I think
it is. I agree. It is just one shade. It's either black or that dark green.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of variation. Tough stuff. All the pros of granite with none of the cons. I mean, that's why they put it in labs, right? Because it's pretty much bombproof.
On the other hand, wood countertops are sometimes popular. And there's some places where that works.
Yes.
You know, certainly any cutting surface, like, like a cutting prep area, a wood countertop can be really nice. If you really want to go the extra mile, you get the butcher block style where you're looking at the end grain because that is what's called self-healing. So you can cut till the cows come home on that and it just doesn't really impact it.
And that is probably the most sustainable countertop at the end of the day, right? Especially if it's locally sourced wood. You know, you can put a countertop and cost-wise, not bad. Not as cheap as laminate, but...
For sure. You know. Well, the butcher block ones are pricey.
The butcher block ones are pricey.
For sure. Yeah. But let me just say, people got to stop putting wood countertops next to their sink.
Oh, God, yes.
They just... Wood cannot tolerate getting wet all day long.
Wood
just can't.
And water are not friends.
It's what's going to happen is the end grain starts to get black, and it just kind of creeps its way up, and it's pretty ugly.
It's bad. Bad news. Well, lastly, I want to touch on this one that's kind of fun that both you and I know, but you especially... is concrete countertops. Well, you have it in your house, right?
I built some concrete countertops for my kitchen, and I've done a couple other smaller, like vanity size ones, which, let me tell you, that's just a lot less work.
I'll bet. Not quite as heavy.
I'll tell you what. So the appeal of it is concrete is a really durable material, and it's not that expensive. And there's a couple different ways it can be done. It can be, the concrete can be poured in place, so you have to sort of
form it all up.
Form the work on top of your cabinets and then finish it while it's wet and in your house. I did the other thing, which was I created forms and basically poured every one of those countertops upside down. But you can add color to it. There's white cement available, so you can really, the range of colors is wide. So my kitchen, they're yellow.
Yeah, but, and they're sweet. You've got some sweet countertops.
Yeah, and you can put little trinkets in there, so little artifacts and things like that. But I mostly enjoy them. I definitely didn't make the best choices when I finished them. I only finished them with a beeswax, and it just has not held up, that it etches out.
Etches. Yeah. So there is, you can put a hot pan down on it, but if you put a drink, has lime or lemon in it or something?
Exactly. There's a lemonade stain on it.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So an acidic sort of thing. Yeah.
So some of that was just, you can actually finish it with like a polyurethane, and I think it's much more durable.
On that note,
if you have any questions about home improvement, carpentry education, why don't you send us an email at thehousealwayswins@wortfm.org. But I'm gonna throw shade if I don't get paid for this housework.
I call it housework. Reproductive Rights for All is partnering with Hands Off Our Bodies this Saturday to protest the unprecedented power grab by the current administration. The goal is for people in all 50 states to show up and show out, calling for an end to the chaos coming from the Oval Office. This will be the first major protest of spring. Who knows, it could be the start of another long, hot summer. To be clear, this is not a comparison between the two events. It's a reminder that many have been fighting for equal rights for far too long. It's also a reminder of what people can change when working together. Born in 1951, Matt Mixon spent his formative years living in central Milwaukee. As a teen, his family moved to the north side. Change is hard, especially when it comes without warning. But what happens when the demand for change is ignored for too long? During the long, hot summer of 1967, black people across the country grew tired of waiting for fair housing, employment, and the end to abusive police tactics. Racial tensions were high, and the city was on the brink of something big. In this archival edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields shares the story of a young man who experienced the long, hot summer of 1967.
In the 1960s, right around 63, my family moved to the far northwest side of Milwaukee, about three blocks north of Silver Spring Drive. It was a bit of culture shock, going from Robert Fulton Junior High to John Muir Junior High, and suddenly being one of just a handful of black kids in my school. Most of my friends, my old friends, still lived in the Central City. So I would often go back into the Central City to play basketball or just hang out with some of my buddies. But around that same time, the Black Panthers were making news. The nation was grappling with the struggle for civil rights. When I started to really notice things, I would say it was leading up, you know, late 66, going into 67. And I did have a part-time job on weekends, working at a slot race car track on the corner of 9th and Burleigh. And it was a black-owned business. It was across the street from Towels Cleaners. And it was kind of a weekend hangout for kids and teenagers. And I remember in July of 1967, when there were riots happening in Milwaukee. I remember standing on that corner, looking out the door of the slot race car track, and I saw a Jeep come down Burleigh. And it was just the strangest thing for me to watch a National Guard caravan, a mini caravan, coming down Burleigh. It just seemed so totally out of whack. When the rioting happened, much of the anger was directed at the businesses that were along 3rd Street. And I didn't see any of that firsthand, because by the time all of that started happening, I was back at home. As a teen, I didn't participate in marches and demonstrations. Living on the Northwest Side, it was just not something that I could get away with. I I always felt Milwaukee was a segregated city. Even when I lived in the central city, I remember that Capitol Drive was kind of like the border. If you went beyond Capitol going north, you really didn't feel comfortable. I remember on one summer day, and I can't tell you the exact year, but I had gotten off the bus at 76 and Fond du Lac. There used to be an ice cream place on the corner there, and I had just enough money to buy that ice cream cone. And I'm licking the ice cream cone, and a convertible pulls up with some white teenagers in it, and they shouted some profanity at me, using that N-word. And I really wanted that ice cream, but I was angry. I was an angry young teen. And as the light turned green, I threw my ice cream cone, and it landed inside their convertible. And I thought, okay, that's it. You know, that's my way of striking back. Come say it to my face, you know. You get big and bad, and you huff and puff, but what are you going to do with it? I was not a bad kid. I didn't, you know, I was not a troublemaker. You know, things like that, I still remember. I think that broadcasting ignored us during those days. I can't say that any of the Milwaukee stations really went into the black community and dealt with some of the big structural issues of institutional racism. The struggle for civil rights, as far as media is concerned, was always a national story, unless something happened like the riots in 67 to get on the radar locally. Back in the 60s and the early 70s, local television stations did do documentaries, but I don't have any recollection of those being about the core community. As I think back about that time, going from 67 into 68, James Brown came out with a song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and it became kind of an anthem for many black teens. I remember thinking, well, I always knew I was black. I always knew I was proud. But to hear those two things connected in a song, all of a sudden it was like a beacon went off for me. And I said, yeah, that's me, you know? And music was also changing the way we listened and the way we reacted. There were a sequence of songs that came out in those few years. I remember Sly and the Family Stone came out with Everyday People around that time, late 68. And then the Temptations came out with Psychedelic Shack in the early 1970. And those were anthems and celebrations, and my community was never going to be quite the same again.
For WORT, I'm Jonathan Field.
Matt Mixon is a veteran writer, editor, and television producer in Milwaukee. Jonathan Fields is an art historian and material culture contributor and curates the Radio Chipzone series. The project is hosted by UW-Madison School of Human Ecology and funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporters were David Ahrens, Maria Segura, and Sutton Johnson. Special thanks to feature contributors D. Star, John Stephanie, and Allie Barini, and Jennifer Fields. Nicole Alley engineered the show, Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm Christina Leffring.
And I'm Amy Owen. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine here on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host tonight, Kate Poppy. Our guest today is Dr. Jen Ray. Dr. Jen Ray is an artist, filmmaker, researcher, and climate advocate. She is the co-founder and researcher for the Center for Reworlding and is currently the artist in residence at UW-Madison. In 2018, Jen co-designed the Creative Resilience Lab, which is an interdisciplinary and interactive program combining artists, scientists, and community members. Together, they participate in dialogue and preparation for climate emergencies. The Creative Resilience Lab is being held at Madison Youth Arts today and tomorrow. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here, you know, on the unceded lands of the Ho-Chunk Nation in this place that they call Dajop. I'm Métis Scottish. Living on the unceded lands of the Jarrah people in Australia, and born in Canada, but living in Australia. So it's really lovely to be here and to be learning from